Now, since I'm going to talk about the order of nature, reason, and will, I have to first explain what order is. And the best explanation I've seen of order is given by Thomas Aquinas in his exposition of the sentences of Peter Lombard. And I want to recall just two things from that treatment that Thomas gives of order. He says that in general, order is a before and after, with the brevity of wit, It's a before and after. He adds that it also involves distinction. Or, he says more precisely, it presupposes distinction. And you can see the truth of this from the axiom of before and after. Now, you naturally know the axiom of before and after, but I'll repeat it. Nothing is before or after itself. So today is before tomorrow and after yesterday, but today can't be before today or after today. So there must always be a distinction between what is before and what is after. Now, it's interesting that Aristotle, in the two places where he discusses the word before, in the 12th chapter of the Categories and in the 5th book of Wisdom, the Metaphysics, in both places, right before he talks about before, he talks about opposition. And opposition is the basis of all formal distinction. So Aristotle must have known that distinction comes before order too. But it's a little bit more complicated than I've said, because the word before is one of those common words that is equivocal by reason. Now, what does it mean to say equivocal by reason? Well, equivocal means it has many meanings. And by reason, that there is a connection and order among those meanings. And perhaps the best text to begin with is not the Metaphysics, Book 5, which will confuse you too much detail and so on, but just the 12th chapter of the Categories, where Aristotle distinguishes in order the four central senses of the word before. And then he adds another sense later on, which I'll mention. The first sense of before that he gives is before in time, like today is before tomorrow. My talk is before dinner and so on. Okay? That's the first sense because it's the before and after in motion. And as Shakespeare says, things in motion sooner catch the eye than what not stirs. Now, the second sense of before is before in being. If this can be without that, but not vice versa, then this is said to be before that. Aristotle's example in the Categories is one is before two. One can be without two, but two can't be without one. Thomas often refers to this second sense as the sense of natural before, and it will be appropriate for my talk later on. The third sense of before is in the discourse of reason. And this is similar to before in being. Just like some things can be without other things, but not vice versa, so likewise some things can be known without other things, but not vice versa. You can know what a line is without knowing what a square is, huh? But not vice versa. You can know what a square is without knowing what a cube is, but not vice versa. And the fourth sense, Aristotle says, is more remote from the earlier senses, but it's an extremely important sense too, and that is that what is more loved is before. What is better is before. Huh? And Thomas, when he gets into very high matters, like he's discussing the Trinity and he's pointing out that the Father is not before the Son, and the Father and the Son are not before the Holy Spirit. And he goes back to this text in the 12th chapter of the Categories to show that. Huh? Aristotle often takes these words, and doesn't give all the meanings of them, he just gives the central or main meanings. And then there are other meanings that are attached from the side later on. But Aristotle will give in his text just the central meanings. But there is an exception to that rule of Aristotle. And that's here in the fifth meaning he gives in the Categories in chapter 12. He says another meaning of before is that of the cause being before the effect. Now this meaning is not fifth in order. It's attached really to the second sense. There's a likeness before being before and being, and as a cause is before an effect. For example, an effect depends upon its cause. Huh? And what is after in being depends upon what is before in being. So Aristotle makes an exception to his own rule. And it's because of the enormous importance of this sense of cause before effect. Huh? Just think of the post-analytics. Huh? Reasoning from cause to effect and effect to cause, and so on. Now, very often, Thomas, in texts that I'm thinking of when I'm giving this talk, he'll say, this is before that and a beginning of it. And when he says before that, he's thinking of the second sense. And when he says it's a beginning of it, he's thinking of this attached sense, huh? I like to say that Aristotle was the first man to understand the words we all use everywhere. Because he's the first man to realize that all these common words are equivocal by reason. And he could distinguish the central senses of them, and he could see the order in which they came. So he's the first man to understand the words he uses. And sometimes I think he's the last man to understand. Huh? Now, with that little preliminary course on order, I want to turn now to the order of nature and reason and will. And I guess to not contradict myself, I've got to distinguish them a bit before I try to see their order, right? Now, I'm using nature here, which is also a word equivocal by reason, not in its first sense of birth, huh? Or even its second sense of the source of the child within the mother, or not even the sense of the definition in the second book of the Physics, that's a beginning and cause of motion and rest, right? And that which it is first as such and not by accident. Not even matter and form, but the last sense that Aristotle gives in the fifth book of Wisdom, nature meaning what it is. Huh? Aristotle sometimes calls the first category substance, sometimes he calls what it is, right? Tiesti. That's the sense of nature that I have in mind in this talk. Huh? Now, reason and will, I won't say too much about. Reason, let's just say it's the ability to think and understand. And will is the ability to love and to choose and so on. Now, why does nature come before reason and will? Well, there's perhaps four or five reasons we could give, at least. One reason I've already touched upon. If the what it is of a thing is in the genus of substance, and reason and will being capacities to do something, and therefore in the second species of quality, and all you logicians know that substance comes before what? Accident, right? Then nature in the sense of what it is must be before reason and will. Any beginning of them, huh? Because they're not accidental accidents, right? But they're properties in the strict sense. So they flow from the nature, from what it is. Huh? Another way of seeing this is to recall that the existence of a thing is connected with what it is. The kind of existence it has, huh, fits what it is. While reason and will are abilities to do something. Now, being comes before doing, I think. Huh? You gotta be, huh? Before you can do something, huh? You can be like I am without doing anything, but you certainly can't do something without being, huh? Okay? So that's another reason for saying that nature is before reason and will, just like being is before doing. Another reason that Thomas sometimes gives goes back to what you see in the physics, where we learn that the things that move depend upon something unmoved. Well, which is the unmoved? Not reason that runs from one thought to another, like I'm going from one thing to another in this talk, right? My reason is in motion, if you can believe that. And the will, right, is always running from ends to means and so on. But nature is something, what? Quite stable. So if the thing in motion depends upon the thing not in motion, that would make us think that reason and will depend upon nature. Huh? Now Aristotle, in the fifth book of Wisdom, points out that one is, it's a property of one, to be a beginning and a measure of things. You can see that in the first meaning of one there, which is the beginning of number, right? And the measure of number. But when one is carried over to other things, it carries that same character of being before a beginning and being a measure of things. Well, nature is determined to one. Why, reason is always open to what? Opposites, huh? And the will is open to opposites when you choose and so on. Well, if the one is a beginning and measure, then nature being more one, nature not being able to be more than one thing, as Shakespeare says, is going to be a beginning of nature, I mean of reason and will. Ms. Dry is what I was saying earlier, I think. Another before and after that's not too hard to see is the famous one that the through itself, huh? Is before the through another, right? And the through itself is a beginning of the through another, right? So if sugar is sweet through itself and coffee is not, sugar is sweet before coffee is, huh? And coffee is sweet through sugar, Not they recommend that, but some people have that weakness, okay? Or if water is wet through itself, but a dishcloth is not, then a water is what? Wet before a dishcloth is. And it's the beginning or cause of the dishcloth being wet, huh? At least in my experience. Okay? Never the reverse, huh? Never made the water wet with the dishcloth. Huh? Okay. Might have squeezed some water out of it, huh? But it was okay. Now, which is through itself, the nature of the thing or these properties, huh? The nature, right? So if the through itself is before the through another, then nature in the sense of what a thing is must be before, huh? Reason and will, which are properties and therefore through another. Huh? So these are some of the reasons why nature is before reason and will. Huh? Now, if someone says, Mr. Berquist, you should know something about teaching, right? And have you forgotten what Thomas says about the teacher in the Prima Pars of the Summa? Huh? That the teacher leads the student from the known to the unknown, not only in showing the order of premises to conclusions and so on, like I've been doing a bit there, right? But through what is sometimes called manuduxio, because Thomas uses the word manuducitare there, he also leads you by the hand in many, many ways. Huh? And one of the first ways Thomas gives is to lead the student by the hand from statements that are less universal. These very universal statements are kind of abstract and hard to what? Grasp, huh? Now, in the time allotted to me, I can't manifest fully that nature or the natural is before reason and will and so on. So I'm going to take my favorite animal there, looking reason, huh? Now, you all know what looking reason is. If you don't speak English, they call it theoretical reason in Greek, or speculative reason in Latin, huh? But if you speak English, it's looking reason, huh? Okay. I want to show how nature or the natural is before looking reason, huh? Now, since seven is the symbol of wisdom, that's why he died at the age of what? 49, huh? As Thomas himself says, the square number has the same symbolism as that of which it is a square. So 49 is 7 times what? 7, right? Okay. So let me go through these 7 ways, huh? Which nature or the natural is before looking reason. Huh? In Plato's great dialogue, the Theaetetus, Theodorus introduces his student, his prize student, the great Theaetetus, right? Who is in the history of math and a very important figure too. He's a young man at this time, and he's introduced to Socrates by Theodorus. In Theodorus, in introducing Theaetetus, he says to Socrates, trying to perk his interest a bit, my pupil is something of a philosopher. So Socrates and Theaetetus begin their discussion. And somewhere in the middle of their discussion, Theaetetus breaks out in wonder. And Socrates at that moment stops, huh? And he says, Theodorus seems to have guessed rightly about you, that you're something of a philosopher. For there is no other beginning of philosophy, says Socrates, but wonder, huh? Now, in Aristotle, in the Premium to Wisdom, at the beginning of the Metaphysics, and Thomas, in his exposition of that premium, comes back to wonder being the beginning of philosophy. He points out that this wonder is a natural, an inborn desire, right? This inborn wanting to know what and why. And this is the beginning of the whole use of looking reason. So this is the first way, huh, in which the natural is before reason. Wonder is before the very use of looking reason to find out what and why. Huh? As Thomas points out in many places, wonder leads us ultimately to seek not only the cause, but if the cause has a cause, to seek the cause of the cause. And so on until you get to the what? First cause. Thomas, in his exposition of the eighth psalm, has a very interesting statement there in the eighth psalm when he's commenting on it. He says there's two kinds of people who follow the natural desire of the mind, this wonder. What are those two kinds of people? He says the wise, he says, and the simple. Now, he doesn't explain there what he means by simple, but he doesn't mean a simpleton. He means something very good, huh? Maybe something like, what, the pure of heart, right? Blessed are the pure of heart, for they shall see God, right? Huh? Well, this is a tremendous thing, this natural desire, right? This wonder, huh, to know what and why. And it's the whole beginning of the use of looking reason. So here you can see in a particular way how nature or the natural is before reason, huh? Before this use of reason. Huh? Now, what's the second way in which nature comes before reason? Huh? Well, let's recall what Aristotle calls philosophy, which is a perfection of this looking reason. Huh? Aristotle often calls philosophy a methodos in Greek, huh? Which comes from the Greek words meta and hodos, etymologically meaning over a road. Huh? The philosopher's knowledge, philosophy itself, is knowledge over a road. Knowledge that follows a road. Huh? Now, one road we follow is the road of reason as reason. The road that is studied in logic. Huh? The art of defining and what? Reasoning, right? My good friend Euclid of Alexandria, right? What does he do? He defines, right? And divides and demonstrates, right? He follows the road of reason, huh? But there's a road before the road of reason as reason. And that road is called the natural road in our knowledge. The road based on the fact that we are animals that have reason, right? And animals are defined by having sense. And what is general comes before what is particular. So the natural road is the road from the senses into reason. Aristotle talks about this road in various places. Like in the beginning of the Physics, he points out that the senses and reason, they go from the confused to the what? Distinct. He calls that the natural road, or an aspect of the natural road. Now, if you think about things you might learn in logic, Aristotle says in logic that induction comes before syllogism. Induction from many singulars to get to something universal comes before the syllogism that begins with something universal. Well, why is that so? Because of the natural road, right? The senses come first, and the senses know only singulars. And it's not until later that reason knows the universal. So induction comes before syllogism, going back to the natural road. One thing you notice about our reason, reason guesses before it what? Knows. Isn't that your experience? And sometimes we get no further than a guess, right? Maybe a good guess, Well, why does reason guess before it knows? Goes back to the natural road, Because the natural road begins in the senses, and the senses know things in an outward way, which leaves us guessing in the beginning. Or take another aspect of the road of reason as reason, Isn't it your experience that reason has to think about something before it understands it? We have to think about it and eventually think it out, before we understand it, Well, why do we have to do that? It has something to do with the natural road from the confused to the distinct? If everything was distinct to me to begin with, right, I wouldn't have to think things out. And it would save me a lot of labor and a lot of trouble, right? So you can see here from these examples how the natural road comes before, the road of reason as reason, and is a beginning of it in some ways. So this is the second way in which the natural is before the reasonable. Now, Aristotle has another word for philosophy besides calling it a methodos. He often calls it an episteme, right? And people try to translate that, like into Latin, they tried to translate it by scientia, right? But it doesn't quite capture certainly the etymology of the word episteme in Greek. Both Plato and Aristotle, whom Thomas calls the chief philosophers, Plato and Aristotle, they both note that the word episteme comes from the Greek word meaning to come to a halt or a stop. Episteme names an understanding that comes after the movement of reason. If I was trying to translate episteme, I would say it's a reasoned out understanding. Thomas often quotes Boethius and the proportion that Boethius gives, that reasoning is to understanding as motion is to rest. So this philosophy is a reasoned out, a thought out understanding. Now, how does that depend upon something else that is natural? Well, if reason understood nothing before reasoning, you would have nothing to reason from. So before reason out understanding, before reasoning, there must be some natural understanding, which Aristotle calls in Greek simply nous. Thomas in the Summa calls intellectus, right? I call it natural understanding, right? The natural understanding of the axioms, the whole is more than the part, and so on. So this is the third way in which the natural is before the reasonable. Natural understanding comes before reasoned out understanding. Now the fourth way is like the third. But reasoned out understanding depends not only upon the natural understanding of the axioms, but there are also beginnings that are private to this or that demonstration, to this or that science. And these, although not as natural as the axioms, they have something of the character of the natural. Take, for example, in Euclid there, all right angles are equal. Kind of obvious, huh? Okay. Not as obvious as the axiom that the whole is more than a part, right? But it shares something of that. Thomas follows the great Boethius, right? Who distinguishes the axioms and these private beginnings, but saying that they are both things known through themselves, which we said before comes before. But Boethius says that the axioms are per se nota omnibus, right? Known through themselves by all. And the private beginnings, like all right angles are equal, are per se nota sapientibus, right? It's quite a compliment. So you guys, they're known through themselves to wise people like you who studied under Euclid of what? Alexander, right? Not to be confused, as they did in the Middle Ages, with Euclid of Megara, right? You've heard the story of Euclid of Megara there. His city was sacked by some invading army, and some of the citizens had escaped, right, being slaughtered and so on. And they came back and were weeping, you know, and what they had lost, you know. And so one guy has lost, you know, his gold, and another has lost his daughters to the ravaging soldiers and so on. They came to Euclid of Megara, and he said, "What did you lose, Euclid?" And he said, "I didn't see anybody carrying off wisdom." That's the last thing they'd be carrying off, you know, when they're looking for gold and good-looking girls and so on. And nobody's seizing wisdom and running off with it, huh? So, this then is the fourth way in which nature or the natural is before reason. The private beginnings, which are known through themselves by the learned, right? By the wise. Okay. Now, what is the fifth way that the natural is before the reasonable? Well, there's an interesting passage of Thomas there when he's commenting on the first book of the Physics of Aristotle. And Aristotle is talking about how the early Greek philosophers, that is, they all seem to be saying that change is by contraries, without giving the reason why it is so. And what is this? Well, Thomas in the commentary says, our reason is naturally ordered to knowing the truth. And sometimes our reason moves towards the truth. Even though it needs a reason for really knowing it. But it moves towards it without what? Having the reason. Well, that's a big help, right? I know from teaching, you know, some students' minds move in the right direction before you even give them the reason. Others are moving in the wrong direction. And that's a problem, of course. Huh? It makes life more difficult for the teacher. Huh? So this is a fifth way, huh? In which reason moves naturally to the truth that it's ordered to before it, what? Sees the reason for it. Huh? Before reason as reason does its work. Huh? Now, what is the sixth way, huh? In which nature comes before reason? Huh? There's an interesting remark of Thomas there in his Praemium to Logic, huh? The major Praemium at the beginning of his commentary on the Posterolytics. He's come to the third act of reason, the art about arguments and so on. He wants to divide the art about arguments. And he says that reason imitates nature so far as it can, as far as it's able. Huh? And then he points out that reason does some things always and necessarily. Other things for the most part, but not always, and sometimes it fails. Huh? Well, reason imitates nature here. There are some arguments that reason makes, which are called in logic demonstrations, which are studied in the prior and posterior analytics of Aristotle, where you have necessity, right? And then you have arguments that are more good than bad, dialectical arguments, rhetorical arguments, but sometimes reason fails. And then you have a book, The Sophistical Refutations, about those grand failures. Huh? But you can find other examples of what Thomas is talking about there. Take, for example, a little fact of biology that you may be acquainted with. If two dogs come together in a certain way, they produce a dog. You know? They don't produce a cat. And if two cats come together in a certain way, they produce a cat. They don't produce a cow or a horse or an elephant or something, right? You see that likeness there between the parents and the offspring, right? Two dogs give rise to a dog, two cats to a cat, right? Not to a horse or a dog. I mean, a horse or an elephant. Now, the Greeks had two arts that are named from reason, huh? Logikē and what? Logistikē. And logikē is what we call today logic. And logistikē was the art of counting and calculating, huh? Adding, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing, right? Now you know from your profound study of logic that when two statements come together in a certain order, what do they produce? A statement. And when you bring two numbers together and you add them or subtract one from the other or multiply one by the other, what do you get? Another number, right? Okay. As one physicist said, a very famous one, if you put numbers in, all you grind out is more numbers. You don't get a number if you put two statements together. And you don't get a statement if you put two numbers together and multiply them or subtract one from the other or add them or something, right? See how that's imitating? Two dogs producing a dog and not a cat? and two cats producing a cat and not a what? Dog, huh? Okay. A lot of times you see in a text of Thomas, you know, he talks about some things as being the beginnings and seeds of knowledge. Huh? Why does he couple those two, beginning and seeds? Huh? Well, seed comes from what? Nature, right? The word seminar comes from the word what? Seed, right? Apparently the purpose of a seminar is to plant a seed that will grow into things, right? Plato and Aristotle and Albert the Great and Thomas are always insisting upon the importance of a beginning. And that a beginning is something small in size but great in its power, right? And so, in pursuing beginnings of that sort, you're imitating nature, right? Who out of a little seed produces a mighty oak tree or something. So this is the sixth way in which nature, what, is before the reasonable, huh? Now, what is the seventh and the last way that I shall inflict upon you? Huh? What is the seventh way? Well, Thomas points out, following Aristotle, of course, that the reason, like the senses, is an undergoing power, right? A power that is acted upon by its object, huh? Rather than a power like the digestive power that acts upon its what? Object, huh? And an object that acts upon a power is naturally what? Before that power's act, huh? Well, what is the object that acts upon reason? What is reason's own object, huh? Well, it's the what it is of something sensed or imagined, right? So now we're back to the what it is again, right? It's before every act of what? Reason, right? As its object is before it. And that's the what? Seventh way, right? Okay. Now, I left out something very difficult that maybe I shouldn't inflict upon you, but I think I will anyway, huh? Okay. Some things I enjoy, you know, a little bit of torture, I think, is something a student should expect, you know. I was talking to a guy who just started teaching philosophy in one of our public universities, huh? And he was explaining what the experience was like, right? What does that expression on their face mean, right? As far as he could interpret the expression on their face, it was, why are you doing this to me? When I would talk with the students about the senses of before, right? I used to like to ask a Peter Piper, piped a peck of pickled pepper type of question, you know? I would say, in what sense of before does one sense of before come before another sense of before? If you want to see why you're doing this to me or torture somebody, right? Okay. So, excuse me for torturing you a bit here. Huh? When Thomas is explaining how nature is before reason and will, he takes not only nature in the fundamental sense there, the what it is that's in the category of substance, but he also speaks about reason itself as being a nature. The will itself as being a nature. He makes a very strange distinction between nature or reason as a nature and reason as reason. And a distinction between the will as a nature and the will as will. He sees both reason and will as partaking of the character of what it is, but in a secondary sense, just as accidents have being, but in a secondary way, right? And you can apply the arguments we gave before, with the exception of the one from substance, right, to see that that is so, right? There are some things that reason naturally knows, and these come before the things it has to think out. There's some things that we naturally will before we make these difficult choices. But this is the beginning of that. That distinction is not like the distinction of dog and cat. If it were, the dog would be a cat that, what, barks. And the cat would be a dog that, what, meows, right? But it's more like the distinction that Aristotle used in his example. You could say it's like the distinction of two and three. Is three two? Not three as three, right? But in a way, there's a two in three, right? And that two could be without the three. Or it's like the distinction between animal and dog, right? The dog is an animal, but not just an animal, right? When I was young, I don't know, maybe high school, I said, man is an animal. My mother didn't like that at all. I don't like that, Duane, she said. Well, I don't mean, Mama, he's just an animal. He's an animal that has, what, reason, right, But nevertheless, his being an animal is something fundamental to him, right? And you can be an animal without having reason. But you can't have reason without being a, what, animal, right? You can have three without, you can have two without three, but you can't have three without two, right? Okay. So there's something that the will wills through itself, and not to another. Something that it reason knows to itself and not another, right? There's something where reason is determined to one. There's something where the will is determined to one. The will doesn't choose between being happy and miserable. It naturally is determined to wanting to be happy, right? But it sometimes chooses the wrong means, right? So nature is before reason as reason, right? Or reason as a nature is before reason as reason. Or will as a nature is before will as will. But coming back now to looking reason, we saw seven ways that nature is before looking reason, Now, what difference does it make, as someone said recently? What difference does it make whether reason follows nature or not? Well, if you have this natural order there of nature and reason, if reason doesn't follow nature, reason is going to begin to, what, wander, right, It's going to become disordered, right? And a disordered movement of reason is the cause of error, right? It's interesting that the Latin word error comes from the Latin word to wander, like the knight errant, the wandering knight. So the fact that the word error comes from the word to wander is kind of a sign that is, what, a cause of error, right? Wandering of the mind. So if the mind doesn't follow nature in these seven ways, it starts to become disordered in its movement. It starts to wander. Shakespeare in the Comedy of Errors, in the middle of the play, one of the characters says, "We wander in illusions." So he uses the English word for that, In the Gospels there's a interesting little conversation between Christ and the Sadducees. And the Sadducees, I guess, didn't believe in the immortality of the soul. They didn't believe in the afterlife, right? And so they're going to try to get Christ in a little bit of a difficulty there, right? You probably remember the story, huh? Man married a woman, and she died, and they had no children. Then his brother, according to the Mosaic law, you know, took her on as his wife, and they lived for a while, and then he died and without any children. And seven brothers went through this whole thing, right? Now they thought they're going to have Christ really in a dither, right? And they said, now in the resurrection, like you believe in them, we don't, but in the resurrection, whose wife will it be? I mean, this sounds like chaos, right? Now, what does Christ say in the Greek text, which is the only text we have? Huh? He says, you wander. Planasai, right? Goes back to the Greek word plane there. We get the word planet. Huh? The planets seem to wander around the sky as distinguished from the so-called fixed stars, right? So that's to get their name, planet, from that same word. Huh? So Christ says, you wander, knowing neither the, what? Scriptures, right? Nor the power of God. Huh? Okay. So this is the way reason falls into error. It's interesting if you take John Stuart Mill or Jean-Paul Sartre, they don't see this distinction between nature or reason as a nature and reason as reason, and between the will as a nature and the will as will. So for John Stuart Mill, all reasoning is open to opposites, and you never really resolve anything. You just keep on arguing, and you know, maybe today we got more arguments on this side than you had, and so we won today, you know, but tomorrow it might be, you know, the opposite, right? Like two football teams playing, you know, and other team might win the next day, you know. And there's nothing that reason is determined to think, huh? There's nothing that reason necessarily and naturally knows. And so consequently, you never have any certitude about anything, huh? But he's just thinking of what? Reason as reason, huh? When Aristotle, in the ninth book of Wisdom, distinguishes between the natural ability and the rational ability, he distinguishes the natural ability, says, is determined to one. The reasonable ability is open to opposites, right? But he's contrasting nature as nature with reason as reason, right? The same thing for the will. And you go to Sartre, huh? And the will as will, what does it do? If I was going to define the will as will, I'd say it's ability to choose between opposites, right? Choose to do this or that, or not to do this, or to do this, and so on. But for Sartre, every act of the will is that. Huh? So even if you talked about happiness and misery, I chose to be happy. You know? It was a choice, a free choice. Huh? There's nothing for him that the will naturally chooses, right? That has tremendous consequences, huh? So you can see some of the danger there of not following what? Nature, huh? So is there any need to prolong this torture? Let me give you just one more example of this reason imitating nature, right? Thomas says in one of his commentaries here, his exposition, Super Job, the book of Job, premium. He says, just as in things which are naturally generated, paulatum, bit by bit, they arrive from the imperfect to the perfect. So it happens to men about the knowledge of truth. So just as nature produces its product slowly and what, in a certain order and so on, right? But bit by bit, very gradually. Like the tree adds another ring every year or something. So reason imitates that, right? Okay. Now, there's a very interesting likeness here between this guy here, Thomas Aquinas, and Niels Bohr, the great physicist. After Bohr got the Nobel Prize, he set up the Institute for Theoretical Physics in Copenhagen, and supported by the beer industry there. And physicists came from all over Europe to study under Bohr, like Heisenberg came from Germany and Gamow from Russia, right? And Oppenheimer from the United States and so on. And he greatly influenced the whole generation of physicists. And this was such an important center that when some physicist had a new idea, some revolutionary idea or some worthy idea, it seemed, he would come to Copenhagen and they'd get a seminar, right? And he'd explain the new idea. But one of the physicists who saw this happen again and again, he saw that everybody would get the new idea with the exception of Niels Bohr. And so in kindness, they turned to Niels Bohr and tried to explain the new idea to him. And after some time of trying to explain it to him, Bohr says, oh, now I see it, now I see it. Isn't it this way? And Bohr would see how he sees it. They say, no, you got it all wrong. Then they have another long discussion. In that discussion, everybody was agreeing with Bohr. Bohr was the last guy to get the idea, but the first guy to get it right. Now, Chesterton thought that this name that Thomas Aquinas' fellow students had given him, the dumb ox, right? It was important enough to use that as the title of his little biography of Thomas. That's the same thing as Bohr, right? The last man to get the idea, the dumb ox, in other words, was the first man to get it what? Shakespeare has a beautiful thing on this when he takes as Friar Lawrence in Romeo and Juliet. It's a beautiful lines here. There's four lines of iambic pentameter with the first two rhyming and the last two rhyming. But he says, for not so vile that on the earth doth live, but to the earth some special good doth give. Nor aught so vile but... not so vile, nor not so good, but strain from that fair use, revolts from true birth, stumbling on abuse. But notice his expression there, revolts from true birth, stumbling on abuse. Shakespeare has moved the word nature there to its birth, right? In English, all the way to the last one that Aristotle and Thomas had seen. What a thing is, Revolts from true birth, stumbling on abuse. So when reason doesn't follow nature, it revolts from true birth, and then it stumbles. It's interesting that Shakespeare uses the word stumbles because it's taken from the legs, right? And of course, in the Latins, it already used the word running for the act of reason. So you see in the Latin logicians sometimes, discursus, which comes from the word running, is a synonym for reasoning, right? So stumbling is when you get into a problem, right? Okay.